Welcome to the Strong Starts podcast with your hosts, Jessica Whitehead and Sarah Gerber-Kai.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Strong Starts podcast. Thanks for joining us here and on social media. We really appreciate it. Today, we're going to be exploring the topic of restraints and seclusions, which is definitely a sensitive topic. We'll be sharing real cases in which restraints and seclusions were used to horrific results. If you do not want to hear these stories, you may want to skip this episode and join us for part two, in which we'll be discussing opportunities and tools for inclusionary practices.
The topic of restraint and seclusion is one that we hate talking about it, but we need to bring awareness to it. Before working in education, I don't think I was even aware that students were ever restrained or kept alone in a room by themselves with school staff. Maybe it happened in the schools that I went to when I was younger, but I definitely wasn't aware that it was happening. And it wasn't even until I was 20 and I was in my first job in education being trained in nonviolent crisis intervention, having to actually practice these restraints on coworkers as part of a training, that I learned what was expected of school staff if a student's behavior is deemed to be a risk of safety. And so this is something that we really want to bring awareness to, not just to other educators, but also to parents, grandparents, aunts, uncles, neighbors, anyone who knows a child in the public education system. Because change first starts with an awareness of what is happening in our schools.
Absolutely. And I'm lucky right now to be a part of a team who's committed to not using restraint, isolation, or seclusion. However, all of those are still, unfortunately, a practice that is still in place across the nation. We're going to dive deep into these practices and discuss inclusionary and exclusionary practices. So before we talk about that, we're going to define terms you will hear throughout this episode and in future episodes. And we're going to start with restraint. Restraint is the use of force, either physical force or with a device, that restricts or controls the person's freedom of movement. So let's give some examples. If a staff member is using their body to hold a student down, that would be restraint. There are some prohibited restraints in education, and you might have heard of some of these in the news. Prone or lying face down restraints, supine, which are lying face up restraints, wall restraints, restraints that inflict bodily harm, or anything that restricts breathing. Depending on the state, corporal punishment may or may not be allowed. So some states, they still allow corporal punishment. Seclusion, also known as isolation, confines a person alone in a room, area, or an enclosure from which they cannot leave. This has been seen as maybe a timeout room where a staff member closes the door on the outside and the student is not able to leave from the inside of the room. By definition, restraint and isolation are exclusionary practices because they remove students from their learning environment. In some states like Washington, restraint and isolation can be used if the behavior poses an imminent likelihood of serious harm. Those are some big words, which mean that there is a substantial risk that physical harm will be inflicted by a person upon themselves or someone else. Unfortunately, this can be a gray area, and we see this a lot. Not everyone agrees if a behavior poses a likelihood of serious harm, and we'll discuss that here in a bit with some example cases.
Well, yeah, because people get scared. Our amygdalas fire and our prefrontal cortex goes offline. And so that decision-making ability is not at full capacity, if at all. And we're acting based on a deep wiring. So you might think it's not safe based on your past experiences or traumas. And this creates a really big issue of a misperception of safety or danger.
Well, and absolutely. I mean, my perception of safe might be different than your perception of safe, depending on the incident and the situation. So before we get into these cases, we're going to look at examples of what's been going on in education and a timeline of some changes we've seen, inclusionary practices, crisis prevention, and differences in special education over time. So before the 70s, most students with disabilities were segregated, with only 20% even participating in public education. But the 70s were a time for change. The Rehabilitation Act of 1973, specifically Section 504, laid a foundation for rights for people with disabilities. Then in 1975, the Education for All Handicapped Children Act guaranteed free, appropriate public education. The push for the inclusion in the 70s and 80s aligned with growing awareness of disability rights, which eventually led to the passage of IDEA in 1990, which introduced the principle of least restrictive environment. By the early 2000s, No Child Left Behind emphasized accountability for all students, and inclusion became more widespread. While all of this was happening and concerns about restraints were rising, programs like MANT in 1975, CPI in 1980, and later Right Response in 1993 began shaping crisis prevention practices. Not only did those programs teach ways to prevent crisis, but also taught professionals how to carry out restraints in a more formalized approach. It wasn't until 2015, I mean, that's quite a few years later, yeah. that UCARU, a trauma-informed and restraint-free approach, was introduced to educational professionals. And even with all of these pieces in place, data is still showing the prevalence of restraints being used on students. Most data is published state by state, but some snapshots are reported federally. One piece of data I was able to pull in 2013 to the 2014 school year, 0.1% of students were restrained. Although that sounds like a small number, that comes out to 49,600 students out of the 49.6 million students who attend public school. That also doesn't account for the number of times each of those students were restrained. Although data plays a huge factor, what we have found is that data is inconsistently tracked and reported. A 2020 recommendation from the U.S. Government Accountability Office notes that restraints and isolations are typically underreported and have made multiple recommendations to the Department of Education since then to improve the data collection of restraints and isolations. One factor in the underreporting is the gray area around the definitions of restraint and isolation, because there really are a lot of debates among professionals on what is considered a restraint and what even constitutes the need for a restraint. Unfortunately, some of those are really just not reported. Despite all of this information, cases of restraint and isolation are still being tallied. The data from the nation as a whole has not shown significant improvement.
So this is the point in the episode when we'll be describing some real cases of restraint and seclusion that have been recorded as part of lawsuits due to the extent of harm done to students. So if you do not wish to hear these described, please skip ahead or join us for part two of this episode in 2 weeks. In preparing for this episode, it's been very illuminating for me, Jessica. Before preparing for this episode, I didn't know, for example, that there are many states that still legally permit corporal punishment in schools. I didn't realize the number of states that permit that restraints be written into an IEP or as part of a plan to improve a student's behavior. And I didn't realize that even in the 2000s, there are still incidences of school staff using restraints in such a way that the consequences are horrific or even deadly for children. And one such case that stood out to me was in California public schools in early 2000s, involving a 7-year-old student with Asperger's, which is a form of autism, and her special education teacher. And this was written up in a report from the GAO, the Government Accountability Office that you mentioned earlier. If anybody wants to look that up, we'll tag it in the show notes. But among the allegations that were listed in the lawsuit against the teacher and the district were that the teacher had secluded the child in a walled-off area of her classroom because she wouldn't do her classwork, that the teacher made her lie on the floor in that prone position, and the teacher even sat on her to restrain her because the child was wiggling a loose tooth. And the child later that day told her mom, "My teacher hurt me and I couldn't breathe." It was alleged that the teacher smeared the contents of a burrito all over the child's face and hair after she refused to eat, and that the teacher kicked her, spun her around, and dropped her on her head, and the child came home that day with abrasions and bruising. The parents also alleged that they had requested in writing that restraints no longer be performed, but the restraints continued. That teacher still held a teaching certificate as of the writing of that report and continued to teach in another district after this case was brought to trial. And at the time of this lawsuit, the laws in California stated that emergency interventions like restraints and seclusions for special education students could only be used to control unpredictable spontaneous behavior. So not a refusal to eat or refusal to do schoolwork, but or even wiggling of a loose tooth, but spontaneous behavior which poses clear and present danger or serious physical harm to that student or to others, which couldn't immediately be prevented by some other response that's less restrictive. And so in reading this, one of the thoughts that came to my mind is just how we become comfortable with increasingly overt ways of trying to control a student's behavior. What might start out small as just like maybe raising my voice or using a stern voice to try to control the situation, if I become comfortable with that, it can grow and grow and grow. And in our efforts to gain that control, we end up pushing our students to do whatever it takes to get that control back, because that anxiety and fear leads us to want to get that control back for us as adults, but also for our children. Students are anxious, they're afraid, and they go into that fight, flight, freeze, fawn response. And their behaviors communicating that desperation to feel safe were some other tools that could have been used by this teacher to control a student's behavior. What were some that were used that weren't even documented in this lawsuit? Those were some of the things that I was thinking about. And so in thinking about that, I thought, okay, well, then what's changed since? So let's skip ahead to almost two decades. This is another lawsuit in California against a school for students with disabilities. And I wanted to tell the case of one particular elementary school student who had an IEP and a behavior improvement plan. This was a little girl in elementary school. And among the allegations of the lawsuit, they claimed that this little girl was crying in a support room and a staff member approached her and she told him to go away. She had past experiences with this staff member of restraint and seclusion and she told him to go away. So right now, all we have is a student huddled up, crying, and a staff member approaching her. Well, the staff member continues to approach her in what was described in the lawsuit as a threatening manner, and the child continued to beg him to leave. Since the staff member continued to approach her, she threw a water bottle in his direction, didn't come close to hitting anybody, and continued to huddle and cry. And the staff member at that point called another staff member over to initiate a two-person restraint. They lifted up the student who weighed, in the lawsuit, said a little more than 70 pounds, and they pinned her to the wall. Then they forcibly spread her legs apart with their legs and bent her head between her legs. She yelled that she was in pain and that she couldn't breathe, and they told her that they would not stop until she had a calm body. Finally, they released her, and she slumped to the floor limp. If the only tool that you have is restraint, you will use it, and then you will become numb to it. You'll have to. For self-preservation, you'll have to become numb to it, because otherwise your empathy would take over and you would never restrain a child. Your wiring's going to change. Your immediate response will be to restrain, and it takes intention and accountability to change that wiring. We can update the law. We can update our policies. But if we don't give our staff alternate tools to use in response to problem behaviors, they're going to use the tools that they have. If our leadership doesn't hold staff accountable to use those alternate tools, our brains are going to stay wired to initiate a restraint when we feel threatened. The response that we have towards threats, it's a neurobiological response. It's built into us. It's wired for our survival. It's protective. And here's how I usually explain it to young students. I say, okay, if you lived outside and a bear approached you, your brain would sense danger. The amygdala, which is in your midbrain, it would send a response to the rest of your body that says danger, danger, danger. And all of your other thinking is going to shut off. You're not going to be able to speak clearly. You can't do your math or your reading. You're not going to be able to fall asleep or digest your food because you don't need to. There's a bear. You need to survive it. And you're going to get a flood of cortisol and all these other hormones in your body that are going to get you ready to fight off that bear, to run from the bear, or hide. And most of us know this as fight, flight, or freeze. We've since added fawn to that list of responses, but we'll talk about that on a later episode. Anyway, your amygdala just saved you from a bear. Yay. But what if it isn't a bear, that it's something else that you're afraid of? Like something that makes you nervous, like a math test or saying goodbye to your mom at drop-off. Your brain might think you're in danger, just like when you saw that bear, and all the same things are going to happen to your brain and to your body. So what if a young student throws a water bottle across a room? And what if that's something that you're afraid of? Water bottles flying across the room or just any object flung in the air? Your brain is going to initiate that same fear response. Your decision-making goes offline and you resort to that deep wiring survival brain to keep you safe. Sometimes that means you fight and we spring into action and we restrain a student who threw a water bottle and didn't even hit you. And then let's take that even a step further. What if a student doesn't comply with your directive? You feel a loss of control. You feel shame. You feel inferiority, like an imposter at your place of work, where you've built a decades-long career. You're better than this. These feelings are threatening. They threaten your sense of self. And believe it or not, your brain may initiate a fear response. And then you're restraining a young student who didn't stand up when you told her to stand up.
You said that really well, Sarah, because I think about that when and when we prepared for this episode, it hits different now that we're saying out for sure. This is something that happens. We have staff members. I mean, I've seen it. Some of you may have done it. A kid is telling us not to do something or they're trying to express their feelings, but we're doing what we want to do. So even if that water bottle was flung at that staff member and hit that staff member and even hurt the staff member, we need to rewind that to the fact that they continued to approach her when she was scared and they continued to invade her space when she was asking for space. And there's a piece there where that student did feel threatened because of an adult mistake. So really, we had to restrain a student. Well, we didn't have to. They decided that they had to restrain a student because of an adult mistake. And that's really hard to swallow. It's really hard to look back and say, hey, this could have been prevented with my favorite intervention, time and space, really. Mm-hmm. And so I've seen that. I've seen staff get hurt because they didn't take a moment to step back. They wanted that control. They were scared. And in that moment, something happened. And we want, on top of that, we want the student to receive consequences for that. Oh, they're physically aggressive. They hurt a staff member. You know, they were restrained. We need to write this up. We need to document it. They need to have in-school suspension, out-of-school suspension. And all these exclusionary practices are happening when really we could have just taken a step back and allowed her to have her space and regulate on her own.
Yeah.
And so that's been the difficult thing to, look at when we are writing down these cases and reading through these cases. And just know that there are a lot of cases out there. Sarah and I had to be choosy, which wasn't easy at all. And we're going to move to New York. And New York has some of the most protective laws regarding restraint and isolation, and the state is still overseeing the implementation of those laws and policies. They really have come a long way since a 2009 incident where a 9-year-old with learning disabilities was put into an isolation room for hours at a time. And they cite it was for whistling, slouching, and hand waving. Parents reported that the room smelled like urine and the child's hands were blistered from trying to escape. The jury awarded the family $1,000 for each time the child was put into the room. And that number was high. I think the total of that was in the $70,000 range. Another New York report notes a 2007 incident where a 13-year-old male diagnosed as nonverbal, intellectually disabled, and autistic attended a private residential school for developmental disabilities. And I'll warn you, the rest of it's a little rough to hear. During a field trip in a van, the student unbuckled, and even though he was supposed to have a special buckle guard, which would have kept him from being able to unbuckle, he was able to unbuckle, so the buckle guard wasn't put in place, and he grabbed another student. The student died by suffocation after an aide sat on top of him for his disruptive behavior. The child was unconscious for 30 minutes before any rescue efforts began. And the staff cited it was a fear of losing their jobs. The aide was convicted of second-degree manslaughter, and he served time in prison, but that time ended. He is no longer in prison. Now, because of that, New York has a ban on prone restraints, aversive punishment practices, which would include mechanical restraints, medical restraints, and seclusion. Corporal punishment is banned in public and private schools, so they did extend their laws to the private sector as well. And the state even classifies corporal punishment as a form of child abuse in both public and private schools. They still do allow physical restraint, but only to stop an imminent risk of serious physical injury. New York did note that this does not include discipline, property damage, or disruption. So that's important. So if we're talking about a serious risk of physical injury, they said it cannot include being used for discipline. It cannot include any type of property damage, so pulling things off the wall, and just disrupting the classroom, like whistling, hand waving, right? And restraint must also be used as the least restrictive option and discontinue as soon as it is safe to do so. Like other states, New York prohibits any restraints that restrict breathing or cause harm. It was interesting, though, to see that New York specified that restraints cannot be written into IEPs or behavior plans, which is great. That's a great step forward. I mean, obviously, we just like a ban on restraints altogether. Any staff restraining students must be trained in restraints as well in New York. They also took out the use of timeout rooms. So you cannot use timeout rooms for that purpose. They can be used as temporary spaces for like regulation, sensory spaces, that type of thing. They also specifies that doors must be able to open from the inside and doors must remain unlocked. Any of those rooms have to have a comfortable environment and always be supervised by staff. The greatest thing, too, that I thought was that they require all school staff to receive mandatory annual training on the use of restraint and timeout procedures. So everyone is trained. Again, I would love for it to not happen at all, but if it is going to be in there, I'm glad that they require it for all staff. And they also implemented a comprehensive reporting system to focus on safety and prioritizing well-being. Because like I said, there's such discrepancy on how these cases are reported. So moving from those cases, we're going to turn to Texas. These are also some more tragic cases. So if you're struggling listening, knowing that that's going to happen as well again. In Texas in 2002, a 14-year-old male with PTSD weighing 129 pounds, was placed into a prone restraint by a 230-pound special education teacher. The teacher laid on top of him, claiming the student would not stay seated. The student died as a result of compression. The death was ruled a homicide, but no criminal charges were ever filed. The teacher currently teaches in Virginia and is still licensed to instruct children with disabilities. Another incident in 2005 describes a 12-year-old male student banging his head against the ground in a Texas residential treatment center. A male staff member dragged the victim to another location and placed the victim into a face-down restraint, lying across the back of the victim. The victim claimed and spoke out loud that he couldn't breathe and eventually became unresponsive after, get this, 10 minutes of being restrained. The victim did not survive, and a grand jury decided not to press charges. The fact that the teachers in the Texas cases were not charged and did not lose their licenses, despite the deaths being homicide, points to a persistent gap between law and what is actually being put into practice. But moving forward, it's clear that despite all these legislative efforts, there is a gap between policy and practice, and students are still paying the price. It's our responsibility to look deeper. Are the students' needs being met? Could these instances have been prevented in the first place? And are restraints and isolations really exclusionary, or are they the result of forced inclusion and needs just not being met? And even more so, are they the result of adult mistakes?
100%. 100%. And who is being held accountable at this point? You know, are we imposing... You've said this before. Are we imposing higher standards on students than we are of ourselves? And so at this point, you should be wondering, why do we even have restraints and seclusions then? Who actually wants this? Now, I feel very confident enough to definitively say parents do not want it. And in fact, in September 2023, Office of the Superintendent of Public Instruction in Washington contracted with the American Institutes of Research to gather some data from parents, educational professionals, students, and they developed a survey, they conducted some focus groups, and they interviewed parents and students. And among the key findings were the concern about the disproportional use of restraint and isolation on students of color, particularly Black males. And further, regardless of grade level, most students subjected to restraint or seclusion in Washington are students with disabilities, students who are male, and students from low-income families. So we do see a discrepancy in how restraint is being used, which, again, kind of, for me, draws up some questions about implicit bias. Who is it that we feel anxious about or that we are nervous about? And both parents and educators report a lack of appropriate systems to prevent those escalations. Like you were saying, are there other systems in place to have those needs met? And according to this survey, parents and educators say, no, those systems are not in place or appropriate systems are not in place to better respond when escalations occur. Parent interviews also noted some consistent accounts from both parents and students saying that they would like to have designated spaces for students to de-escalate and supportive adults who are trained to confide in and provide those alternative tools when managing escalations.
Well, absolutely. And from what I know and what we've seen and all the data, staff don't want it either. Special education staff were surveyed in a study conducted by Melissa Boston at George Washington University, and one participant stated, "I think that restraint is needed in very limited opportunities to maintain safety, such as a student running towards the street. And we do happen to have a lot of busy streets right by our playgrounds, for instance, where you need a trained person who knows the proper way to do that. But it should be short-lived. Seclusion, I would love to see seclusion completely go away. I think it induces a lot of trauma. I think it can be overused and turned into a power struggle. You know, I've been in situations where there's three of us holding a door closed while the student's inside the space. And it just, you know, it was a traumatic experience for me. So I'm sure it was an overly traumatic experience for the student. When you get into situations where it seems like that's your go-to solution for behaviors, you know, it's very concerning. And I feel what she's saying, because I've been in a situation where my heart is just breaking the entire time. And I've had to tell people, no, I'm not doing this anymore. Like, this is not okay. And yes, as much as it's very traumatizing for students, I mean, there's a lot of studies that show that. It's also shown to be traumatizing for the staff members involved as well. And I hope that there's no staff members that walk away from restraint or an isolation that say, oh, I feel good about that. I know the few that I've been involved in, I have not. And I've had to step away and just put my foot down. Like, I'm not doing this anymore, because we don't feel good about it either. And you're right, staff don't want it.
No. And when things like that do happen and it's very intense for us, we have to try to make sense of it. Our brain is going to try to make sense of it. And so some of us tell ourselves this story that it must be necessary that we do these restraints and seclusions. There was an unsafe behavior. I did the hold and the behavior stopped. And I feel that sense of relief. I did something that changed the student's behavior. But that's a false narrative. And what happens is we had to distort the chain of events in order to justify what happened. When we start to tell ourselves a story, or when we have to make sense of what it is that happened, because what most likely happened is there was an unsafe behavior. I did the hold. The behavior stopped. I released the hold. And then a new behavior pops up, or the previous behavior continues. Maybe not that day, but nothing I did was restorative or educational. So chances are the behavior is going to reoccur at some point. And chances are I did the hold after the unsafe behavior occurred, meaning I didn't even stop the unsafe thing from happening. I just took some physical control of the child after they did the unsafe behavior. And sometimes there is a piece of this narrative that's accurate. And this is where strong starts can really come in. Because maybe the story I tell myself is, well, I have to restrain because I can't just do nothing. This behavior isn't safe. I have to do something. And part of that is true. You do have to respond to unsafe behavior. And if a restraint is the only thing you've learned, then that's the only thing you can do. But it's the job of those of us who know differently, specifically our educational leadership, that's who I'm speaking to here, to step in and to coach, model, and hold educators accountable to using those other tools besides restraint and isolation. That's where we can have some strong starts here. Because when we give people other tools, we undermine the story that I have to restrain. It's the only thing I know how to do. Okay, so we know parents don't want it, staff don't want it. But let me say, students don't want it either. No student wakes up in the morning and says, I hope I get restrained by my teacher at school today. Period. We've had numerous experiences, Jessica and I, of debriefing with students after restraint or seclusion was performed. And that student, you know, students as young as 5 years old saying, that hurt. I didn't like that. So staff don't want it, parents don't want it, students don't want it. Then why is it that bans, restrictions on restraint and isolation, why aren't they passing? There have been attempts to pass federal law that's basically restricts restraint and isolation only to those situations, those emergency situations of preventing imminent danger. Those haven't passed, and why not? Well, at this point, the National Educators Association, the Union for Educators, hasn't taken a position on that act that's trying to be passed. It's called Keeping All Students Safe. That's the one that would federally restrict restraint and isolation. They haven't taken a position on it. Instead, they've left it up to the states, which ends up creating this lottery for students depending on where they live. Do I live in a state where I'm likely to get restrained or isolated, or don't I? North Carolina, for example. And I wanted to highlight the state because I found it unsettling, but very interesting what their law says. Their laws allow restraint and isolation and even corporal punishment in a wide range of situations, from breaking up fights to what they call maintaining order, which very gray area what that means, or even to calming a student. Restraint is allowed in order to calm a student. And parents don't have to be notified that a restraint or seclusion took place for up to 30 days. On top of that, the funding for special education is capped below the national average. So how can we expect for new tools to come into place, the opportunities for training, if we're capping that funding to support our students with disabilities? Compare that to a state like Washington, which spends more money per student annually and recently lifted its cap on special education funding.
Geez, and this topic really is divisive, and not just in a political sense, but in the way it touches on core principles and the different beliefs we have just about raising our children. And you think about that too. I think about all the things on social media about, you know, we mom shame, we dad shame, we parent shame, or we always are giving this advice on how to parent. And just that in itself is so debatable. Mm-hmm. And I don't know about you, but this topic as a whole is just, it's overwhelming and emotional. It's important to recognize the steps we've taken as a country, but we also have to realize there's more steps that we need to take. More schools are adopting trauma-informed training, and more states are passing legislation. We really do need to shift from how do we control that student to what does the student need to feel safe and supported? If you're wondering what you can do, just stay informed. Advocate for better policies, accountability, training. Ask questions. Be an advocate for your child in schools. There are several groups like the Alliance Against Seclusion and Restraint that are devoted for this advocacy. I know there's a lot of parent groups out there, a lot of advocates in the state, but speak up for your kid for sure. I know if it were my kids in that situation, yeah, I don't even know what I would do. But really, thank you for listening and joining us to this tough topic. Hopefully, by bringing awareness, we also ignite change. So until next time, thank you for listening to part one. Stay tuned for part two, because there will be more, which will drop in 2 weeks. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and follow us at Strong Starts Podcast on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok. Bye, everyone.